A car is never just a car. Kelley Blue Book knows it's so much more than that. It's your commuting chariot, your road trip refuge, your I just need a reason to get out of the house. Your car is there for everything. And for everything car, there's Kelley Blue Book. Need a new set of wheels? Price it on Kelley Blue Book. Problem under the hood? Fix it with Kelley Blue Book. Can another car do the job better? Trade it or sell it on Kelley Blue Book. We're here mile after mile, moment after moment. Price it, fix it, trade it, sell it. KBB.com. Visit KelleyBlueBook.com to get the journey started.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And now,
it's time for
Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast.
Dun, da, da, da.
Da, 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 da.
It's Inside Conan,
an important Hollywood podcast.
And this week we have an interview we did when we were in New York.
Wait, who are we?
Oh, please. Doesn't it say when it comes up on your phone and who the hosts are? Maybe it doesn't. I'm Mike Sweeney.
I'm Jesse Gaskell.
And we're writers of The Conan Show, and this show's all about things going on behind the scenes of Conan, but also it tackles world problems and politics. So I think it's the only podcast you need in your life.
We also have a weekly cocktail recipe.
Yeah, that's right. For entertaining.
No, we don't do most of those things. But we
Why not lie?
We do have interviews with former Conan writers such as Brian Stack.
That's right. Brian Stack joined the show in 96 and has an encyclopedic memory of every experience at Late
Night.
Oh
my God, he does.
And he's one of the most beloved, well-known writer performers from the late night days.
Yeah, and he's truly one of the nicest people I've ever met.
Yeah, no, he's great. Almost it's an act, but
disturbingly nice. Yeah.
On the surface, incredibly wonderful. No, he's very, very thoughtful and sweet and just an amazing. I know. Every time I see him, I'm like, it's got to be an act, damn it.
I know. You almost want to throttle him and provoke him into telling you what he really thinks of
you.
Exactly.
Maybe we do, or maybe we don't.
Yeah, maybe we do. No, this was one of the interviews we did in New York.
Yep.
That's where Brian is now because he writes for The Colbert Show. Is it called that?
It's The Late Show, yeah.
The Late Show. Yeah. Stephen Colbert.
Of course.
So that's where he is now, and he's in New York.
Let's talk to him.
Great. Right. I'm nervous to interview this guest.
You are?
Yeah.
I love
that. Notorious hard ass.
Oh, man. He is.
One false move with this guest.
I know. The rage comes boiling over.
You will feel his verbal stings.
No, we have with us the nicest man in Hollywood.
Oh, you're too kind.
But we're in New York, where he's a prick.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly.
One of the meanest guys in New York City.
It's coastal dependent.
Exactly. We're here with Brian Stack.
Brian Stack. Legendary.
Oh, you're
he is legendary.
It's so great to see you both. It's been too long, and I miss you.
Yeah. We miss you, too.
Oh, he's Miss Stack.
But we still get to see you on TV, which is exciting.
Mm-hmm. Oh, thanks. It's always fun to see you, too.
We came all the way to New York just to talk to you.
Oh, well, it means a lot.
Because, really, it's true. No, we were here for the upfronts.
Sure.
And they're like, well, why don't you interview some people? And of course, you're at the top of everyone's list.
Yes.
Well, thank you. It's great to talk to you again.
But you're hard to get because you have a job. So that's
I know. I love trying to just schedule this. Originally, it was going to be tomorrow, which is you shoot two shows on Thursday?
We do. Usually we shoot.
You work at the Colbert Report.
Yes.
I'm not the Colbert Show.
No, it's okay.
Yeah.
We usually do two monologues at least, and sometimes the show gets pieced together, you know, in pieces. But today was a little crazy because it was the CBS upfronts too.
Oh, and, today. Okay.
Yeah, so I know everybody's going through that this week.
Right.
Too. So,
were you guys involved? Do they suck you into them?
Material for it?
Like Conan had to appear at the Turner, now the Warner Media upfront. So I didn't know if you guys got roped into writing stuff or if Stephen had to do anything.
Some of the writers didn't. Stephen did do something over at the upfronts, but I was kind of working on other stuff today. But it was fun to watch, you know. Just it's always a little strange to watch those things because
so weird.
The advertisers, you don't know what kind of an audience they're going to
no,
be.
No, yeah. I know.
A rich audience.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hopefully it goes well. I remember Conan doing them too. And when Little Jay Leno came out years ago.
That was for a famous. we had a character, Little Jay Leno.
Yeah. What?
That's great. A little person who did an. Oh, he looked exactly like Jay.
It was an Andy Blitz special.
It was in one little beat of a long kind of pageant sketch that a writer, Andy Blitz, did. Mm-hmm. And the reaction to this Little Jay character was so electric. It was like, afterwards in the hallway, we're like, what are you doing the next four months? Because we're going to have you on all the time.
He was also Little Gene Simmons in the band Little Kiss, where they would do Kiss covers, but they were all little people. He was great, Joe Fatale.
And so they wanted to borrow him from our show for the upfront, but they screwed it up. Like you go ahead.
Well, I think they introduced him as Jay Leno, not as Little Jay Leno.
Right.
So I think the audience was very confused why this little person in a sports car was driving out onto the stage. But
he might be short in real life. I mean, maybe the show is shot with forced perspective.
Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
And the car broke down. It was a toy car, and I remember.
Right.
And it was Radio City Music Hall, which I don't know is like a football field wide stage, and car stops. He's waving. The audience has no idea. Like, why did they say this is Jay Leno? and then stagehands had to. Do that walk of shame, come out and slowly push him across. It lasted 10 minutes.
It
took him 10 minutes. Great upfront moments from years past.
But you have a great memory, Brian.
Yes.
You remembered that actor's name, which is incredible. But I just remember starting at Conan and you always had great stories.
Yes.
Oh, thanks. I used to tape like all the shows and like all bits and musical guests and stuff. So I think sometimes I remember
that
stuff just
you.
Because I watched it more than when it was just on the first time.
Oh, so
I
and
I would tape all the
Twitter,
musical acts.
You often will post some of your favorite clips.
Yeah, I really geek out on Twitter with music stuff or old comedy bits. Like I'll post McCann and Matt Walsh last week. I posted them doing the What Hurts More channel.
Oh, you wow.
Because Matt was finishing up with Veep and I was just like, just made me think of the What Hurts More channel, which was just McCann and Walsh being insane,
hitting each
themselves
other.
With stuff.
Right.
So yeah, it's fun. I do. I love all those old clips, and I love that they're all going to be on the Conan website now.
Well,
I know
let's
a
not
lot of
rush
them
things.
Oh yeah, eventually. I'm always grateful to the fans that put them on YouTube because I don't know how to put stuff on YouTube. So I'm always so grateful that a lot of our old silly bits are floating around, you know.
Do you get recognized a lot from just walking around New York City?
Very rarely. Like I think partly because I think, as you know, like a lot of the characters I did, I was buried under wigs hats and beards.
You don't wear those costumes anymore? Well, the interrupter?
It was usually, like, if I looked like myself, it was usually a bit for someone else. Because, like, if I wrote it myself, I would usually put crazy stuff on. But the Slipknots I did occasionally get recognized for because I looked like myself.
That's true.
Like an Irish bartender at on 48th Street goes, "You're one of the Slipknots."
Oh!
And I was like, "Yes, I am."
Oh, that's great. He's a nuthead.
Exactly. Without the sweater. They put the Slipknots remote up online.
I love that. That was really fun to see.
When you guys opened for the actual band Slipknot.
That was so insane. I remember just before we went on stage, you might have heard this, but the stage manager goes, "Be careful out there, guys. These fans throw batteries at the bands they like."
Right.
So Glazer's like, "If I get hit with a battery, man, I'm going to be really..." And Blitz, we ran out on stage and the crowd hated us just as much as we hoped they would. They were booing and throwing beer cups and giving us the finger. And Blitz said later that we should have run out for an encore.
An encore, yes.
Which I really wish we had, but we'd probably be dead.
Yes. So. He talked about that on the podcast.
Yeah. That's right. I heard that.
And I could see I'm sure Glazer was like, "Oh, no, man. No.
We went on after Lamb of God and before Slipknot."
Oh, you were the middle?
So Lamb of God's out there with their like Cookie Monster metal vocals like, "Dah, dah, 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 dah." And then we come running out and the audience was so confused. And
oh, I love you. I didn't realize there was a band on before you guys.
They were really intense too.
So the crowd was warmed up and ready.
they were.
For you three.
It was so surreal to go out, because I'd been to arena shows, but I'd never gone on stage at a place that size.
Yeah.
So it kind of hit us all of a sudden when we hit the stage how huge it was.
Yeah.
And how confused the crowd was.
We've made a mistake.
Was. Right. Yeah, it really, that was pretty obvious right away.
It would have kept running right off the other side.
Exactly.
So you're working at Colbert, and it's 5 days a week.
It is, yeah. We don't usually tape on Fridays,
right.
But it's kind of like the old Conan days where,
right.
You know, we would have one day where we would work, but not mm-hmm. necessarily
try to
tape.
Get ahead on the next week.
Yeah, exactly. Work on upcoming stuff. And
but your show's so topical, it's probably hard to bank stuff. I don't know.
Sometimes it is, because I know sometimes some of the stuff later in the week, you know, by necessity is a little more evergreen or
right.
something. Like, it's an interesting process, because I know in the Conan days, like a lot of the stuff we did, if it had to wait 2 weeks from then, it was just like Tommy Blatcha lassoing cupcakes or some insane right. thing. It's like, this isn't time sensitive.
Yeah.
People know cowboys 2 weeks from now and rope tricks.
Or McCann doing the world's oldest stuntman
right.
running down the stairs. And I do love just pure silly like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a fair amount of that.
It's my favorite stuff.
I thought of you, a character that you did, the crooner ghost.
Oh, yeah. Artie Kendall.
Artie Kendall.
Yeah, that was...
just because of the Kate Smith controversy.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That was crazy. I was genuinely shocked that there were songs that... Like, I knew...
Yeah, we can't even talk about...
I know.
That's true, exactly. But it was weird because, like, I always was like... Artie Kendall was a racist, misogynist monster,
right.
you know, who got murdered. I thought his lyrics were so above and beyond in offensiveness from what really existed. And
right.
I guess they were kind of in the ballpark.
Yeah, yeah.
No. I wonder if we can put those up online now. You know,
right?
Maybe you could. It was funny because originally we had done some other bit where Michael Gordon had someone half faded in. And I was like, wait, how do they do that? And then I got the idea that, what if a ghost appeared? And,
right.
and I started thinking, well, Rockefeller Center's been here since the 30s.
Right.
There were probably old crooners like Bing Crosby mm-hmm. singing in
right.
this very studio. And it just kind of evolved from there and got darker and darker.
Right. And you'd be like, here's a little ditty sing for the ladies out there.
Well, I remember hearing that Bing Crosby had this dark side, and it
right.
always seemed very strange to me that a guy who's like, hey, Junior,
right.
who would also have like this
right.
horrible...
Horrible side.
Horrible dark side.
Did he talk about how he had been murdered? I mean, did we know?
He did, yeah. At one point, I think it came up that he was beheaded
mob.
By the League of Women Voters. Or something. I think they forced him to dig his own grave, or something. And he deserved it.
And people really liked it, and then it got hard to keep. It's like with Wiki Bear, it's like
keep pushing the envelope.
Right.
Well, it was weird too because I didn't think I'd be doing it more than once. So otherwise, I would have varied the song a little bit. It was always the exact same melody.
It was.
Yeah. It's like wait, no one calls you out that it's the exact same melody every
right.
single time.
I kind of love that about comedy bits that where they don't like. I mean, some people might think that's super lazy, but I just kind of love it's the same melody.
Yeah, there's an obvious thing that no one talks about.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly.
I always appreciated that people didn't make a stink about that, like that
right.
they just kind of roll with it.
Well, the internet was young back then.
That's true.
Now.
Well, and we should just, you brought up Wiki Bear.
Yes.
But that's, I think, one of my favorite bits that you've done.
Yes.
But that, I remember when that came about, it's a sort of a perfect example of your talents because initially there was a sort of a different joke for Wiki Bear, right?
There was, yeah. Todd Levin and I were...
Yeah, you and Todd would bang them out.
Yeah.
Yeah, because
right?
it came out... There was a new toy Wiki Bear coming out that was using information from Wikipedia. And we started to joke that, well, Wikipedia isn't always completely reliable.
Right,
so
right. Mm-hmm.
I think it was going to be that he... had a lot of misinformation. And then in rehearsal, one of the stories was a little bit dark, and Conan started joking, why not just talk about the Manson family, Wiki Bear? And so, and I know way too much about that stuff.
And so, Conan does too.
Right. Yeah, so we just started riffing about the Manson family. And I remember Conan saying in the rehearsal, I think this is the bit. I think it's Wiki Bear talking about...
He always goes really dark into...
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then it would end up being the Donner Party and the Black Plague and all
this
horrible thing. But it would always be...
There was an endless
kids,
well of...
So that's why it's sort of the perfect use of your really upbeat character, but then... Yeah, always.
Hey, kids.
Exactly.
I think someone pointed out that was a recurring theme in a lot of stuff I did. Even when I would write stuff for Joel, our old announcer,
right.
It was positivity.
Yes.
But really dark stuff being presented in a really positive
yes,
way.
Yes.
And I think I've always been a sucker for that. Stuff that freaks me out or scares me in real life, it's my way of kind of dealing with it.
Right.
Or it's a cathartic kind of thing to write about it.
I think I've told you this. I think I saw you angry once.
And oh, I remember that.
I think you didn't. You were coming around.
You remember
the corner.
The one time you were angry.
Oh, I remember the That's one time great. It made an impression on Mike because yes. My shoulder was really bothering me, or I'd hurt my back or something. Right. And there was another time though too where Glazer saw me.
It's scary.
It kind of freaks people out. Like, Jack McBrayer saw me get really mad once. Glazer was doing a bit that wasn't even my bit, but it was really funny, and it was with a wireless mic. And it started failing on him.
Mm-hmm.
And it had, for some reason, the bit had to be done that day. So it got ruined by the mic not working. And I was so frustrated with it. I was in Conan's dressing room with McBrayer. This is long before he did 30 Rock. It was when he used to do bits for us.
Right.
I just like, what the fuck? And I threw my script down. And Jack said later, that was like watching your dad cry. Because he's like, he'd never seen me get mad. But it was like, it was just, I saw Glazer's bit get ruined. And once in a while, it just, and I cleared my desk once. Glazer was walking into my office and I was on the phone, really frustrated about something, and I was late for rehearsal or something. And I just literally took my arm and sweep cleared my whole desk in
great.
One motion as Glazer walked into my office.
Wow.
And he just stared at me like, I think if I learned to express anger in a healthier way, those things wouldn't happen.
Every 7 years.
Yeah. Like a comet.
That's probably what I learned from my family.
Yeah. Wow.
Save it
up and then explode.
It. Yes.
Yeah.
Then it comes out in an irrational outburst.
Oh, man. I wish I had seen you. I'd like to put stuff on this desk and have you sweep it off as a final moment today.
Were some of those things that you swept off plates with peanut butter hummus on them?
I always had so much crap and soda drink cans. And I saw an old photo of my office
really
in 30 Rock. It was just covered. You couldn't even see the desk. It was just so covered with crap.
Levi, who took over your office, says he'll occasionally find like peanut butter or something somewhere on the desk.
Whoa, man. I've always been classy.
Well, no, but for the most part, you're known for being just one of the most cheerful people.
Yes.
Oh, thank you.
To the point that I sometimes, when I first was getting to know you, I was like, is he making fun of me?
Seriously?
It's like, he's just so nice, or he'll say good job on something. And I'm like, I know it wasn't that good of a job, so he's got to be sarcastic.
Well, I think it's hard for people in comedy. I struggle with this too, because a lot of times we're coming, like what got us into comedy was all this like insecurity about, are we doing a good job? And I get the same way when people are positive. I'm like,
right.
Are they just...
is not a comfortable place to be.
Yeah.
Just show me avoid eye contact with me. Then I relax. I'm like, okay, I know, I get this. Yes, they didn't like what I did.
Yeah, I remember Conan saw me pacing in the airlock at outside Studio 6A once in my early days at late night. And he said, Stack, you know what you are? You're one of those playwrights in the 30s pacing in front of the theater in his tuxedo waiting for the morning papers to arrive. And I was like, he always had the perfect metaphor for things.
Yeah.
You used to say Dorf was like a 19th century construction worker or a gang member. He goes, Dorf, shouldn't you be off throwing cabbages at Lincoln's inaugural train? So he would always have these riffs where he would sum us up with historical references.
Specific historical, yeah.
Dorf wouldn't fight in the Civil War.
Exactly.
Still mad at Lincoln. No, he had what was his basic riff for you?
Oh, God, I'm trying to remember. He used to sometimes jokingly come up with nicknames. Like, he'd go, Stack, you alabaster ape, because I'm so pale.
Oh, right, you were the alabaster ape.
He yelled that at me once, and it was always, the funny thing was with Conan, it's always with total affection, but I always wondered when people would come in from outside the office, they would sometimes think, like when he was making fun of Jack from being from the South or something, he was doing it with nothing but love and affection, and he would only do that to people he liked. But sometimes I would like, do outsiders know this is a bit?
Right.
Because he would sometimes walk in, there'd be four of us on a couch and be like, Mount Rushmore of incompetence or something like that. And I'd be like, we all know he's just, that's just him joking around.
Yeah, but part of you Wonders.
There is. Is yes, really in the a back joke. Of my mind.
Well, he went after Jack in a long riff in that Conan O'Brien Can't Stop, that oh, tour right. documentary. And I know people who said to me, like, oh, I really... Yeah, and I was so used to that. I just like, oh, there's some really funny lines in there. And mm-hmm. and Jack's clearly, it's back and forth.
Right.
But people are like, oh, that I like the documentary, except that part where I don't know why he went after that poor Jack McBrayer like that.
And Jack's such a good improviser that yes. he would roll with it and look hurt.
Right, so he'd be right.
Like, oh, that's not how I talk.
Yep.
And
his acting is too good.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, he would play it very realistically,
right.
like his feelings were being hurt, even
yes.
though he knew it was a joke. But a lot of sometimes the crew guys would even think Conan was being mean to him.
Yeah.
And it was yeah. understandable yeah. if you watched it. It was very realistic.
I remember Jack's first time on the show in a sketch, and he was so funny. It was all the writers were just like, oh my, like immediately.
I remember that bit.
It was that your bit?
It was my bit because I had
done.
It
was so funny.
Well, I had done that in an ASCAT. It was the overconfident prison inmate.
Uh-huh.
And it was just, I had come into a scene in ASCAT, and
yeah.
I thought, oh, Jack's so much better for this than me
because uh-huh.
He's just got that cheerful,
yeah.
like, so we had him in a really pressed prison shirt and he came in and there were two huge guys with tattoos mm-hmm. lifting weights and he goes, hi guys, I'm new here and I'm taking over. And they just immediately kill him with the weights.
Like with the bar, this guy just plonks him in the face yeah. with a barbell.
Exactly.
He goes right down.
Oh,
it was
great.
He was absolutely perfect for it.
He was great.
I think you could tell Conan loved him immediately.
Yes.
Yeah.
Just and like with Amy, when Amy would come in and do
right.
bits, like
right,
Amy
right.
Poehler, you know, mm-hmm. in the early days.
Yep.
The UCB was like a rep company for us early
yeah.
on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yes. It was amazing. They were on
just
all the time. And they elevated everything.
Tube.
They did. They always made everything better.
Amy and Matt Walsh did a satellite channel that I remember one of the first times I saw them, and I was like, holy cow. It was, I think, a simple idea. It was a husband and wife news anchor team.
Oh, yeah.
And they started doing the news, but then they started sniping
oh,
at
bickering.
Each other.
Yeah.
And it elevated to Matt Walsh just going, grrr! And just overturning the desk and storming out. And
fantastic.
They were, yeah, they were great in everything.
Yeah, the first sketch I ever wrote was Andy's little sister and Amy.
Was that the first one you wrote?
Oh my
it
gosh.
Was. And
Amy Poehler was in your first
been,
sketch
it
ever.
It was. Well, she was.
It's been all downhill.
We knew
you.
Her in Chicago. It was kind
yeah.
of. And we knew her in Chicago.
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
I was originally going to get a real 13-year-old girl for it, you know, like get a real. And
uh-huh.
Then we were like, could Amy look 13? And when they put her in the pigtails mm-hmm. and the
oh
headgear,
mm-hmm.
and the performance was just.
Right.
And I felt so bad afterwards because I thought I was so new that I didn't know that the audience doesn't really read along with the cue cards. They're looking at the monitors.
Right.
So I was like, hey, can we do it without cue cards?
Because oh.
then they won't see it. So she memorized.
Oh, you're kidding. Oh, so they actually went along with that. They didn't use cue cards.
She didn't use cue cards, at least the first time we did it. And I felt so bad later on because I had never done a bit in the audience.
Right.
I didn't know how
right.
hard that would be.
Yeah.
And she nailed it. And
wow.
She's always
yeah.
fantastic, obviously.
I always worried about that with anything with the audience. Just reading,
yeah,
that was my fear, and reading along, and
they do like to.
Getting to the joke. I used to go to the cue card guys like you're putting up the punchline too soon. And,
oh yeah,
but none of that matters.
I realized later most people are just watching the monitors
right.
to see the
they're
sketches.
Watching TV no. so they don't have to.
That's
read.
Right,
yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
I don't want to read your stupid cue cards in different colors.
I
didn't know that was your first sketch. That's
I think it.
That
was.
Must have felt. Fantastic. It was.
Yeah, no kidding.
Well, I
yeah.
think in some ways, like, I think that might have been one of the reasons I was kept on, too, because I was originally, I don't know if you remember this, I was supposed to be there for 13 weeks.
Oh,
I don't remember that.
Because I was filling in for Tommy Blatch, who uh-huh. broke his leg. And
right.
I thought I was going back to Chicago, and it turned into 18 years.
Oh, my gosh.
And I sometimes wonder if that was one of the my at least part of the picture
you had a
because
home run right away.
Well, and
yeah.
she made it. It was such a simple idea, and she's the one that kicked it into this
right.
memorable sketch because it was a very simple
right.
idea, and she just nailed it. And I don't know for sure if that's the case, but I think it definitely helped.
You were hilarious and prolific.
Yeah, I'm sure
I think.
That you
yeah.
one performance of yours, and that would have kept you around too.
I don't remember doing stuff early on though, like
did
as
you
a
not?
Performer. I did
yeah,
a
what's
little bit.
One of the-
I remember I would come in as like a doctor and just hand like a clipboard to somebody or something.
So
but,
beneath you.
Yeah, I think that was.
Yeah.
But it was always fun. And,
you know,
I remember Actual Items being one of my favorite things to write early on. And
Actual Items was great.
Yeah.
Those were fun.
Everybody loved
we would make a pile of them. There'd be like 30 or 40 of them. Mm-hmm. And it was fun to just rehearse all. And a lot of times we do ones that we know, oh, there's no way.
That's just for Conan.
Yes, yes. Remember, just for him to get mad.
Or ones that are so dark. Like I remember one for an ad for knives. I think it was Tommy's, and it just said, knives are quiet. So sometimes they were dark, but they were acceptable.
Right, right, right.
Then other times, one was for an oven. And I remember it said, startle the natives with your firebox.
Oh, my gosh.
So they were all insane.
Right.
They were always...
Well, let's go back. So you said you came out from Chicago just to do this 13-week gig.
Yeah, and I was so
how
thrilled.
How did they find you? Was it through Andy? I mean, who were your sort of connections at the show?
I think it was partly Brian McCann and Greg Cohen and Tommy and Andy knew who I was. And I think they recommended me to send in some ideas. Mm-hmm. And luckily, they liked them enough to – I don't know if I would have gotten hired as a full-time writer from the packet I sent in, but they liked it enough to bring me out for the 13 weeks. And then – luckily, they liked the stuff I was doing after that, but I'll always be grateful that I got to work there so long. And, for the 13 weeks alone, I would have been grateful, but to stay 18 years with so many great people.
That's amazing.
You know, it was just
What were you doing in Chicago at the time? Like, were you auditioning for things or were you just enjoying doing, were you
improv
doing Second City?
I'd been working at Second City for the previous 4 years.
Yeah.
And it was kind of feeling like, even though I loved it there, it was kind of feeling like I was feeling kind of an itch to try something new anyway. So the timing was ended up being kind of perfect.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But I loved working there. But like I had known McCann and Andy from the old improv scene there and all the UCB people and Colbert and Carell and all them were like heroes to us, like watching them on the main stage. And I still remember Conan coming to town in the summer of 93 with Smigel. They were looking for I think they were still staffing up, and they came to one of our improv shows, and I still remember that. And so there's still like this small part of me that thinks of Conan as a new guy,
which
is insane because that was 26 years ago.
Right.
But there's still this part of my brain that thinks of him as
who's the kid?
New guy,
because
he was like 28 or something.
So were you guys all like, who's this guy? Because I know stand-up comics were, you know, that guy's not a comedian.
Well,
he can't host he can't take over for Letterman.
Well, I had heard how hilarious he was from my friend Claire, who used to date Bob Odenkirk. Said, there's this guy who works with Bob at SNL who's just, everybody says he's the funniest guy in the room. And I remember the name Conan because it was an unusual name. Mm-hmm. And I was like, and then when he got the show, I go, oh, that must be, that's got to be the guy.
It turns out it was a different Conan.
I know, exactly. That would have been, that'd be nice if it was more common.
Why did they get the other one?
But I had heard how hilarious he was. And I always heard he was like, one of the funniest writers, you know, and there was always a part of me knowing that he'd come out of improv and everything. I always know that maybe it's just a prejudice I have coming out of improv, but I was like, I wasn't really surprised when it worked at all, you know, but even though he was, might have been really nervous early on, who wouldn't be, you know?
Yeah. His stories about the early time where like, oh, wow, we had to learn how to perform in television cold.
Yeah.
Like there's no warm up. There's no like, oh, well, you'll have a little show on, you know, Comedy Central.
Right into these big shows.
But back then, Comedy Central wasn't as big as it is now. Or I know people who started hosting little kind of interstitial shows and kind of got their sea legs that way.
Yeah.
There was none of that for him. You know, it's just get out there.
Trial by fire. Absolutely.
Yeah. Terrifying.
It must have been. I give him credit just for having the courage to do it. I've always admired like the fact that you all have done stand-up and came out of stand-up. I could never imagine doing stand-up. Like, I always needed to be on stage with other people, like in an ensemble. So
improv is so much scarier.
Yes, to me, improv is, the few times I would do it, I'd be like,
I need to go write stuff down first.
Can I be a bystander on
it's
this
so funny
sketch?
To me that so I've heard that from a lot of my stand-up friends, and I always feel the exact opposite. I'm always like, no, you're up there by yourself, and you're being yourself. You're not like playing a character. Mm-hmm. You can, I suppose, play a persona. But I always was like at Second City, they used to even make fun of me. If I had to go out and stall and talk to the crowd by myself, I'd be like, oh, please don't make me go.
I'll do anything other than that.
I would watch you do the warm-ups for the crowd or McCann doing the warm-ups. And I'd be like, I could never do that. And so I had so much respect
for it.
That's
crazy.
You know,
I can never do what either of you do.
Yeah.
I really can't.
Oh,
no, I'm serious.
Of course you could.
Now it's getting really bad.
So Brian, when you moved to New York, then did you get involved with UCB here? Or what? When did you start performing there?
When I first got to town, we had known the UCB people, as I said, in Chicago. And so when I got here, it was so nice to know a few people. Like when Amy and Matt Walsh and Matt Besser and Ian Roberts left
Chicago. It wasn't competitive because it was like, oh, the two long-form improv schools or...
Oh, well, actually, because there was no Second City here in New York.
Yeah.
Like, and Amy... all of them, most of them had worked in the touring company at Second City too,
mm-hmm.
but they had, when it was so nice when we got to Chicago, when we got to New York to have this little community on Sunday night to go do the ASCAT show,
mm-hmm.
because it was like a Chicago reunion every
right.
week, and it felt like you were going bowling, you know, with your friends or something.
Right.
So it was just, we would cling to that, and the early days, they didn't even have their own space at the time. It was this rented space on 17th Street, Solo Arts, but I could tell right away, like, people started getting interested in them teaching classes, and I don't think they'd come here with the idea of teaching classes, but that kind of just all evolved, and then I just, it's amazing how much it's grown.
Yeah.
Because it was so small. Same thing happened in Chicago with Improv Olympic and now called I.O. and
oh, right.
Everything just exploded, and the L.A., as you know, the UCB in L.A. is huge
now.
Oh,
yeah.
Right.
Do
you know when they came to New York, UCB?
96, I think.
Okay, so it was right... a few months or a year before you came?
I got here in April of 97, mm-hmm. and they had already kind of established ASCAT right. as a Sunday night thing, mm-hmm. but it was, and they were getting small kind of loyal followings, and a lot of people who later ended up becoming UCB regulars, like John Ross Bowie and mm-hmm. Rob Riggle and Brian Husky and all them used to just come and see the shows, and then they got involved, and, mm-hmm. and it was... It just couldn't believe how fast it grew.
Yeah. Well, there really was a lack of improv, weirdly, or maybe not so weirdly, there weren't a lot of improv groups in New York City. So there was a real, it was fertile ground.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Andy Daly said there was like a Chicago City Limits, but
right.
I don't know exactly what they were doing, but Andy Daly and some of those other people were doing stuff there. But they said, as far as improv goes, there wasn't much.
No, there wasn't. It was mostly like there's a lot of too many stand-up clubs.
Oh, that was when you were doing it pretty regularly.
Yeah,
right? Yeah.
That's how you know there were too many clubs.
But I worked regularly. But you were awesome.
Everybody
knows that.
No.
Yeah, they do.
Drummed out of the business.
Well, I remember you guys always talking about Catch a Rising Star and everything.
Yeah, Catch a Rising Star was great. It was fun.
Do you feel like improv has really helped your sketch writing? I mean, do you get a lot of, over the years, have you gotten a lot of ideas for characters from improv shows?
Well, I was consistently amazed how often just us screwing around in the office. The office
would
always
get
felt
on
very,
air.
Yeah, it often felt very mm-hmm. improvisational. Mm-hmm. Like the Bulletproof Legs thing that McCann did, that was from us just screwing around in the office.
In the writer's room.
Yeah, or McCann doing the FedEx Pope. I remember him putting the FedEx, he put a FedEx box on his head and was just blessing us.
He'd go around and tell the writers, I bless you. And especially in the environment where we
late
have
night.
No show the next day.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, you're going to wear that hat on the air.
Yeah. Well, that's how Slipknot's, you know, it was probably 1 a.m. the night before, and we noticed the band Slipknot was on the show,
yes.
and we had no comedy.
Yes.
Yeah.
And a lot of the best stuff was just from desperation and sleep deprivation.
Absolutely.
And pizza.
Yes.
A lot of pizza.
I remember we had mice running through the halls in the early days.
Yeah,
and
right. A lot of mice.
Tommy Blatcha would throw cornbread at them and go, "Get out of here, mouse." And he would throw exactly what the mice wanted
exactly.
at them. So he would.
And then more mice would come.
Exactly.
And he'd have to throw more cornbread.
Jesse, they would seriously be just running down the hall.
It was awful.
I remember the exterminator coming, going like, "Do you guys know you have mice?" "Yes, we're feeding them."
Yes,
actively.
Tommy put sandwiches in the ceiling tile.
Yeah, that is true. Over many, many months. I think when they redid that floor, is like, I don't want to be around when they pull down the tiles in the conference room.
Yeah, after that, I don't remember seeing
it
anymore.
Yes. You know, it's funny, you're talking about giving people their kind of, like using Jack McBrayer and other people. You know, I was thinking of Paula Pell recently.
Because
we used to use her.
She's
and,
awesome.
And we loved, she was a writer on SNL.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I don't know whose idea it was to start using her. Did you know her?
I did not know Paula, okay. But I had seen her in like opening bits,
right,
at SNL, and didn't know her name. But I thought she was very natural and real,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
and very funny. And she always would deliver. She just you could always tell she was a really great actress.
Great. We started using her a lot.
Yeah, she
and
was
she
great.
Was
yeah.
hilarious. She was great.
Yeah, she's. I remember seeing her. A few years ago in Birdman in a small part as just a Midwestern mom.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that's great. And you know, it was always obvious she should be doing more acting.
Right.
You know? And J.B. Smoove.
Yes.
He
was a writer at SNL.
Uh-huh.
And I was always amazed, why isn't he on camera? Because, like, I think Michael Coman might have discovered,
I couldn't remember. He brought him in for a sketch and was, well, he's J.B. Smoove. But we had never, we hadn't seen him before.
Yeah.
And we're like, oh my God. We can't believe this guy's up at SNL. And they started getting mad at us because we started using him like two or three times a week.
But I wasn't seeing him on camera on SNL. And I was like, another case where you weren't surprised that they went on to do other stuff.
I think that's very common though, where you're working at one place and in one capacity and maybe it's
they don't think of you
they
that
don't
way.
Think right, of you that right. way. And so then, but someone else coming from the outside, like, grabs you. I mean.
Yeah, like Tim Robinson, you know, who has that hilarious new sketch show. I guess he was mainly writing at SNL.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, this is nothing against, like, the people who have been on camera on SNL, because there's been so many great people. But sometimes some great people kind of get a little underused, you know.
Right.
Well, it's so hard there. There's so much. So many talented people.
Yeah,
it's
it sounds like
be.
Such a, you're playing like 12-dimensional chess politically. And
I'm sure.
Yeah. When I hear stories about SNL, that 12-dimensional chess aspect.
It's all like Game of Thrones.
man. That is a tough environment. Because I know people, writers there, and they, they were like, I would go home every night and cry.
Oh. Yeah, it was always a dream job, for so many of us in Chicago. But looking back, I was like, I don't really know if I could have handled it, that kind of intensity. Like, Late Night had such a nice, it was high profile enough that you were getting your stuff out there on television, but I never felt like we were under that kind of scrutiny and intensity.
Exactly. It was the scrutiny. Yeah, it just seemed like a lot more pressure. And also, for us, the one fun thing was we were so desperate to fill the show every day that everyone was just like kind of collaborating and trying to help each other get stuff on, which was great.
Yeah, because you felt like, well, if it doesn't get on today, if we like it, it could be on tomorrow or
we'll have
Thursday.
Time to fill tomorrow too.
Exactly.
Lassoing cupcakes.
Exactly. Yeah, because it didn't feel like it was your bit or my bit.
Right.
It was like, hey, if we like them both, they'll both get on.
Right.
Which is always really nice.
Well, it does seem like that sort of that time early on when you started, Brian, you were sort of under the radar still enough that people could kind of there was experimenting happening. And did it feel that way when you started there? Like
it felt like that at the TBS show, too. Like, I've always felt.
Under the radar.
I mean that in the best way, like not under the radar, but there was always a sense of play and experimentation and a kind of, what the hell, let's try it atmosphere.
Yeah.
And I always really appreciated that because we could really take some big swings. And sometimes you'd completely miss, like I always remember. And sometimes it would be stuff that would make us cry laughing, like Glazer did this character, the Reverend Otis K. Dribbles.
John Glazer.
Yeah, who was just wearing a hound dog mask dribbling. I can't possibly translate this over a podcast.
No.
But I was literally in tears, crying, laughing, watching it. And there was no response from the audience. And the only reason it stayed in was because when they cut to Conan, he just said, there is no more. That's it. And that got a laugh. But so often, a lot of our favorite stuff was felt like it was more... we loved it,
more
and we're
niche.
Like, we hope the audience would love it. And sometimes when they did, it was the perfect storm, but
he'd refer to it sometimes as not comedy.
Right.
But I still argue with him about, we had an argument about Otis K. Dribbles a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
Like, he brings that up.
Yeah.
That's his example of, the writers just going off.
Up their own asses.
Yeah. Exactly. And I'm like, I still think that's hilarious. And we're working on the archive to put online some old, and I looked at it alphabetically. We did it five times.
Oh, really? Which,
oh, that's great.
Which I kind of love because I remember he hated it the first time we did it, but we still forced it
four more times. That's a,
Yes.
That's a recurring bit.
Well, those would often be the things that other comedy writers would bring up, like, or people that later became comedy writers.
Right.
Because I felt like that about when I would watch SCTV.
Right.
I remember Rick Moranis, Conan said at the Aspen Comedy Festival, Rick Moranis said to him, if we'd had a live audience, we might have cut a lot of the stuff people love the most.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Because it wouldn't have gotten a big audience response, but it was stuff that comedians at home and future comedy writers found so inspiring.
Right.
Because it was like, wow, that was kind of like just for me or something.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, it feels kind of like this precious little secret thing you found.
I remember discovering that show in college, like coming home, and it was on some weird station down on the dial, and just like, oh my God, I have to watch this now every week.
I was the same way. Oh, it wasn't promoted or anything. It came on after SNL, and I was like, what is this? And it was like stumbling onto this pile of gold.
Yeah. And before, I think before it was on after SNL, it was, I think it was just syndicated. I could be wrong. Like, it was before Martin Short was on it. And
yeah, this was the syndicated one with Harold Ramis.
And all the
really early low-budget ones where it was just done up in Edmonton in a little studio, and they had no audience, and they were just doing what made them laugh.
Oh,
and
man.
It was great. Yeah. And that's how our working with you, we were always really trying to make ourselves laugh first.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's why I think I have so many great memories of working there, was just because it was always fun to just try to, it would be like, I really want Sweeney to laugh at this, or Jesse, you know, just to, and if the audience doesn't go for it, as long as the crew is laughing.
Yeah, a room of comedy writers is much harder to get on board than...
Unless sometimes it's late and everyone wants to go home.
Yeah, yeah.
All of a sudden, everything's funny.
I know.
So we got something for tomorrow? We're good? Okay, good. Let's get out of here.
Well, you learned, I remember early on, I said, I think that'll work. And John Groff said, okay, you figured out the difference between what will work and what you like. And it was like, there are times where you're like, okay, it's 2 a.m. This will probably work. And we'll try to come up with something we like better. But sometimes it's a volume business.
It is,
The other late night, like a lot of times at 10 p.m., it'd be like, this isn't that funny, but is Abe Vigoda around? Because at least the crowd will just cheer seeing Abe. It was awful.
We used to bring Oldie Olsen in a lot. Sometimes it felt, because Oldie was so reliably funny, they'll be like, and then Oldie will come in and do something.
Yeah,
right. But half of the thing with him was him going off the rails.
Right.
So,
exactly.
Yes, there's certain times you just kind of felt dirty, like, we're putting Oldie in as a less beat.
We'll figure out what he does later.
Right. But he's available. We'll figure it. We'll reverse engineer it.
Exactly. I always knew we were trying to make it the best we could.
Right.
And there were just times where, but I loved that we would just take some swings, you know. And that was the most fun thing about working there, was just like,
a lot of swings.
Let's see what they think.
Yeah.
Well, and it is, I mean, it's sort of, that's what I think is the blessing and curse of writing that type of shows, that it is what it is. Like the final product, sometimes it's great, sometimes it's just the best thing that you could do in the time you had.
Exactly.
But, you know, you can't dwell on it too long.
Right.
You have to do something else for the next day anyway.
Yeah, we had one sketch Tommy and I worked on once. It was just this passable thing, and I remember he came by my office and he goes, slot fill. Like, we filled a slot. Like, he said it with great pride.
Yeah.
We basically just filled a slot.
Right.
Yes.
<You know? laughs> No, everyone gets very cynical about it quickly.
You're always trying to do something really memorable. And, and sometimes you do. That was the magic of it. You're always shooting for that.
You know, it's funny. Did you have a preference for pre-taped things versus doing live? There's a real excitement to doing live sketches on the show. Obviously, you have the crowd there, and the stakes are high. I used to enjoy, like, there's almost like safety hiding out doing a pre-tape, because you get to edit it and kind of control it, and you know, it's a different kind of energy to putting it together and everything.
It is, and I love them both for different reasons. And I was always amazed, though, how much could be added in editing.
Like,
yeah.
Like when we did the inappropriate Clive Clemens' Inappropriate Response Channel.
Right.
Like, Tommy put in a lot of effects in the editing room
yes.
that made it much funnier than mm-hmm. it was just, than it would have been doing live.
Right.
But there was an excitement to doing stuff live because it felt, with the size of the theater being kind of small,
which
it felt
great.
Like you were in a live theater, like in a kind yeah. of a black yeah. box theater yeah. in Chelsea or something.
Yeah.
So sometimes I would forget that it was going out into the airwaves. Mm-hmm. Like, you felt like you were doing it for the people in that room.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes I think that was a self-preservation thing
right.
where in your head you're like, it's just for these people.
Right, right.
You know, and,
oh, that's
when you
the
were
only
so
way to think about
oh, yeah, absolutely.
I never thought about it being on TV.
I didn't either. And
yeah.
I think that was probably healthy, you know,
sure.
to just kind of just say, okay, we're going to do it for these people.
Oh, no, but Jesse's right. You were always like money in the bank. You,
oh,
I don't
yeah.
remember you ever making
yeah.
a single flub ever.
I know.
Thank you so much. I always tried not to.
It's like you're more comfortable in front of an audience
yes.
than even just like one-on-one, I think.
I definitely am. I've always been more comfortable like performing than I am like at a party or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was funny. Sometimes when things would go wrong, though, it could be really fun. Like when I remember once I stumbled during a Wiki Bear line and Conan called me out on it
uh-huh.
and we ended up having fun with the fact
or
I came down the stairs once as God and that ended up in a blooper reel
oh,
and I
yeah.
slipped because I'm clumsy I'm clumsy in the best of circumstances and with sandals on I'm really hopeless and I was coming down the stairs and I slipped a little and he's like, God, have you been drinking? And it ended up being this conversation and I was like, yes. So sometimes, or like when McCann's wig fell off, he shot himself once and his wig fell off and he's just laying there supposedly dead, but he's laughing. And
sketch we watched over, we definitely have to get that online. I don't know if it is. I think that was, I saw it recently. It's was part of a Super Bowl preview. I was like, what did that have to do with the Super Bowl?
But
and Andy Blitz is in it.
He hits Blitz with a bottle and then shoots himself.
Right.
Like it made no sense. And they were just a couple of wild men, crazy sports fans. And a lot of times those were my
great
favorite
physical
moments.
Yeah. But yeah, we used to have a lot of guns on the show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think sometimes I know we would fall back
a lot of
on
suicide.
That.
But that was Ava Goat is not available or Oldie. Okay, just shoot someone at the end.
I know.
And throw it a commercial.
And I remember when we did Bulletproof Legs, McCann kept asking for more and more blood. And I think the censors ended up complaining. They're like, you can't have that much blood.
we used to. You should explain Bulletproof Legs.
Oh yeah. I was sitting next to McCannon and in a writer's meeting, we were just waiting for it to start, and I pretended to shoot him in the leg, and he started singing a song about having bulletproof legs, and so I shot him in the chest and he fell off the chair dead.
Oh.
And we're like, oh, just the legs are bulletproof. And we're like, that could go on the show tomorrow.
Oh yeah.
And it was literally a complete accident. And I remember the guy who was protected from 2-inch bees,
three-inch bees.
Yeah, that was from just McCann having a letter tray over his face. So a lot of the times, and it was like, it looked like a beekeeper's thing, but it had big gaps. So it's like certain size bees could get through it easily. And
it was a long sketch where
it was a lot
of McCann putting male paraphernalia on his head.
Yes, it's true.
And it becoming a sketch.
Yeah,
there were so many
wonderful
box.
Little accidents, you know, mm-hmm. like that. Like
I there's a question for McCann. Preparation H. Raymond. I have no idea.
It was originally
that started in the room too, I think.
I remember the first time he appeared, he was in that sketch where he was originally called the Seeker.
Right.
Because he was a guy who was always showing up when he was looking for some big answer to something.
Right.
Yeah.
And then
that was the Be Yourself gang.
That was another.
What was the name of the sketch?
2 a.m. desperation
2 a.m. Hail Mary pass.
Yeah, that was insane. And I remember McCann added in the Preparation H part later, and I don't know why, but it stuck real nicely.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a character you loved that you wish you could do more? Or I know after a while you did God a lot, and then after a while I think Conan's
when you played
like,
God on Colbert also, right?
Oh, in The Ceiling, it's more of like an animated puppet.
Oh, okay.
But I have it's like a animated puppet thing. I always enjoy doing it, but I know sometimes we can push something a little too far and it can get a little stale sometimes. You know, I know with some characters at late night, we like we tried to do a second inappropriate sketch a little too fast because the response was so great to the first one.
Right.
And I felt like we rushed it.
Oh, I don't remember that.
We tried to squeeze too much juice out.
Yeah, we did it. We tried rushing it and it wasn't part of a satellite batch the second time, so it wasn't really protected.
Yeah.
And it was okay, but I kind of wish we left it alone as the one. So sometimes I feel like I've been guilty of pushing stuff a little too far.
It was the nature of doing five shows a week, and if something's popular, it only makes sense to do it again.
There was one bit that we did called Destructo that was about Tommy was an alien who'd been sent to Earth to destroy Conan. And his finger had been genetically designed just to push a button to destroy Conan, but he kept getting distracted by mundane things like his girlfriend's like, why don't you drive Billy to karate practice? And he's like, and he would get telemarketer phone call.
Right.
But he's like, prepare for your destruction. And I remember Liz and everybody in the crew, Liz Plunk, our old director, and everybody was like, you guys will be doing a lot of these ones. Because everybody was like, this is really funny.
We were crying and it was a tour de force. It was really funny.
And it got... I remember you could tell from the first time we did it that the audience did not share our enthusiasm.
No.
I blame the audience.
It was one of those things where I was like, well, I can't say they're wrong, but we really did love it. And that was one where I was like, we were just a little off from what they wanted. But man, I like to think people at home enjoyed it more than the people in the room.
Yeah. I know. Sometimes you go, okay, the studio hated it, but... the phrase? It'll play well at home.
That happened with the kids show.
It'll play well at home.
Well, the all kids audience?
Yeah.
I remember watching that at home that night and I was just rolling on the floor laughing at how hilarious it was. And because it was an all kids audience, the whole premise was that we were bringing guests that they wouldn't be interested in, Myron Kendall.
Right.
We had an economist.
Yeah, an economist and all this stuff. And
we really leaned into pissing off
our
audience of 9-year-old children.
And your gut instinct as a performer is when you're hearing silence that it's failure.
Yeah.
But then I watched it at home later and I'm like, oh, yeah, most of the people watching at home aren't little kids and they're really enjoying this insanity.
That show, when we try to walk the balance of stuff that children would hate. And so, you know, grown-ups would find that funny to watch. But at the same time, we were like, maybe we got to occasionally try to make them laugh. But
pander sometimes.
Yes, exactly. And we thought we had pander stuff that would get us like almost all the way through the show. But within like 4 minutes, we're like, no.
Well, they didn't even like the pander stuff.
You just started running out of steam.
Well,
they were onto us, and they were just like,
You remember the boredom monster?
Yes.
There was a monster coming down the hall that could sense kids' boredom and was going to come in and eat everyone.
Right.
And so he's coming down the hall, and the kids are like, boo!
We're going to put that whole show up online soon.
Oh, that'd be fun. I remember it ended with silly string and everything.
So the children in that audience who are now grown with families can...
Yeah. Oh, now they'll finally find it funny.
Audience members they were. Yeah.
I'll occasionally bump into old interns of ours, just at Grand Central or something, and they have kids now. It's very strange.
Oh, wow. That is strange.
That was like, I realized now I started at Conan 22 years ago, and I'm like, there's kids who they're all older than I was when they were interns, and it's even stranger when they come back as guests, like Ellie Kemper, former interns.
I know.
They come back as guests. It's always, or John Krasinski.
John Krasinski's one. Yeah. Ellie, I remember, and she met her husband.
Yeah, Michael. Yeah.
Michael Coleman, who's a writer. And when the iPhone came out, they did that great sketch.
That was great,
about all the different things you could do with it. And it's really crazy to watch that sketch because one of the scenarios is they're using the iPhone as a baby monitor.
Oh, that's right.
And she's pregnant and they're looking, they're having a baby together. And
now they have
that
one.
Was it's, before they were even
they weren't dating?
Dating
yet.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
That's right. That's
as far as we know.
Yeah.
Yeah, not that, as far as I know, they weren't.
Yeah.
But
we'll never know. There's no way we can find that information. All right.
Brian, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. It's so great to
really
see you both again.
You. Yeah.
And really miss you. And it's great to talk to you again.
This is great. It's great to catch up.
I know. And I know our listeners are going to, you're just, you're one of the greats. You are
thanks, Jesse.
So such a big part of the the show throughout its many incarnations.
Yep.
Well, I'm very grateful to have been a part of it, and especially since I wasn't supposed to be there very long.
I forgot that. I love that.
I know.
Story.
I did
That's
too.
Great.
I was so grateful to have the years that I had there, and
it would have been neater if it was you were supposed to do 13 weeks and you ended up staying 13 years.
Exactly.
18 year, it doesn't line up quite right.
It doesn't. Yeah. It's not as poetic.
I would shorten it to 13 years.
I will. For future
Going
stories.
Forward, yes.
Well, we can edit that.
Yeah. All right. Well,
thank
thanks
you, Brian.
A lot.
Thanks so much.
Okay.
Hope to see you soon.
You too.
Bye.
Well,
all right.
That was it.
That was our show. And can't wait to see you guys next week.
Have a happy and safe 5th of July.
Yes.
I know some of you celebrate that. I think that's the Canadian 4th of July. Mm-hmm.
And we're trying to get Robert Mueller on the show because I think he's a big Conan fan. We're trying to scoop Congress, so we'll try to have him on before the 17th.
Yeah, so
no promises.
Tune in next week to see if we got Mulsey.
I mean, we sent an email to his office.
Mueller@gmail.com.
I haven't heard back yet.
We will have an episode next week. I don't know if it will be Robert Mueller, but don't worry about it. It's going to be great. Why are you acting like it's not going to be good?
I don't know why you're so negative about Robert Mueller. I think we can get him.
Yeah, we'll probably get him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We'll lure him in with our erectile dysfunction.
You know who we probably
ads.
Could actually get is James Comey. Like he is doing the rounds.
That is absolutely true. We're the only show of any kind that hasn't had him.
It's true.
All
yeah.
right. Well, so Comey, okay. Mueller, if not Mueller, Comey.
Great. We'll see you next week. We like you.
Inside Conan, an important Hollywood podcast, is hosted by Mike Sweeney and me, Jesse Gaskell.
Produced by Kevin Bartelt.
Engineered by Will Becton.
Mixed by Ryan Connor.
Supervising producer is Aaron Blair.
Associate producer, Jen Samples. Executive produced by Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross. Jeff Ross at Team Coco. And Colin Anderson and Chris Bannon at Earwolf.
Thanks to Jimmy Vivino for our theme music and interstitials.
You can rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts.
And of course, please subscribe and tell a friend to listen to Inside Conan on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or whatever platform you like best.
Ta-da!
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
People think the new fresh fragrances from Glade are fresher than fresh, like creator Kate.
This Glade Orchid Neroli candle is so fresh. It's like fresh as watching a sunrise in Santorini. Yeah, I'm going to need more of those.
Explore the new Glade Fresh collection today.